Aelin. Aelin was... Arcus neared the earth, talons splaying. Aelin hit the ground, rolling, rolling until she uncoiled to her feet. Right in the path of that wave. Oh, gods, Fenris breathed, seeing her too. They all saw her. The queen on the plain. The endless wall of water surging for her. The keep stones began shuddering. Rowan threw out a hand to brace himself, fear like nothing he had known ripping through him as Aelin lifted her arms above her head. A pillar of fire shot up around her, lifting her hair with it. The wave roared and roared for her, for the army behind her. The shaking in the keep was not from the wave. It was not from that wall of water at all. Cracks formed in the earth, splintering across it, spiderwebbing from Aelin. The hot springs, Kaol breathed. The valley floor is full of veins into the earth itself, into the burning heart of the world. The keep shook, more violently this time. The pillar of fire sucked back into Aelin. She held out a hand before her, her fist closed, as if it would halt the wave in its tracks. He knew then, either as her mate or Kerenam, he knew. 3 months. Rowan breathed. The other stilled. 3 months, he said again, his knees wobbling. She's been making the descent into her power. For 3 months. Every day she had been with Maeve, bound in iron, she had gone deeper. And she had not tapped too far into that power since they'd freed her because she had kept making the plunge. To gather up the full might of her magic. Not for the lock, not for Erewhon, but for Maeve's death blow. A few weeks of descent had taken her powers to devastating levels. 3 months of it? Holy gods. Holy rutting gods. And when her fire hit the wall of water now towering over her, when they collided, "Get down!" Rowan bellowed, over the screaming waters. "Get down now!" His companions dropped to the stones, any with an earshot doing the same. Rowan plummeted into his power, plummeted into it fast and hard, ripping out any remaining shred of magic. Elite and Lorkin were still too far from the gates. Thousands of soldiers were still too far from the gates as the wave crested above them, as Aelin opened her hand toward it. Fire erupted. Cobalt fire. The raging soul of a flame. A tidal wave of it. Taller than the raging waters, it blasted from her, flaring wide. The waves slammed into it, and where water met a wall of fire, where 1,000 years of confinement met 3 months of it, the world exploded. Blistering steam, capable of melting flesh from bone, shot across the plain. With a roar, Rowan threw all that remained of his magic toward the onslaught of steam, a wall of wind that shoved it toward the lake, the mountains. Still, the waters came, breaking against the flames that did not so much as yield an inch. Maeve's death blow. Spent here. To save the army that might mean Terrasen's salvation. To spare the lives on the plain. Rowan gritted his teeth, panting against his fraying power. A burnout lurked, deadly close. The raging wave threw itself over and over and over into the wall of flame. Rowan didn't see if Elite and Lorkin made it to the keep, if the other soldiers and riders on the plain stopped to gape. Princess Hassar said, rising beside him, "That power is no blessing." "Tell that to your soldiers," Fenris snarled, standing too.
"I did not mean it that way," Hassar snipped.
An awe was indeed stark on her face. Rowan leaned against the battlements, panting hard as he fought to keep the lethal steam from flowing toward the army, as he cooled and sent it whisking away. Solid hands slid under his arms, and then Fenris and Gavriel were there, propping him up between them. A minute passed. Then another, The wave began to lower. Still, the fire burned. Rowan's head pounded, his mouth going dry. Time slipped from him, a coppery tang filled his mouth. The wave lowered farther, raging waters quieting. Then roaring turned to lapping, rapids into eddies. Until the wall of flame began to lower too, tracking the waters down and down and down, letting them seep into the cracks of the earth. Rowan's knees buckled, but he held on to his magic long enough for the steam to lessen, for it too to be calmed. It filled the plain, turning the world into drifting mist, blocking the view of the queen in its center. Then silence, utter silence. Fire flickered through the mist, blue turning to gold and red, a muted, throbbing glow. Rowan spat blood onto the battlement stones, his breath like shards of glass in his throat. The glowing flames shrank, steam rippling past, until there was only a slim pillar of fire veiled in the mist-shrouded plain. Not a pillar of fire, but Aelin, glowing white-hot, as if she had given herself so wholly to the flame that she had become fire herself. "The Firebringer," someone whispered down the battlements. The mist rippled and billowed, casting her into nothing but a glowing effigy. The silence turned reverent. A gentle wind from the north swept down. The veil of mist pulled back. And there she was. She glowed from within. Glowed golden, tendrils of her hair floating on a phantom wind. "Mala's heir," Irene breathed. Down on the plain, Elide and Lorcan had halted. The wind pushed away more of the drifting mist, clearing the land beyond Aelin. And where that mighty, lethal wave had loomed, where death had charged toward them, nothing remained at all. For 3 months, she had sung to the darkness and the flame, and they had sung back. For 3 months, she had burrowed so deep inside her power that she had plundered undiscovered depths. While Maeve and Cairn had worked on her, she had delved, never letting them know what she mined, what she gathered to her, day by day by day. A death blow, one to wipe a dark queen from the earth forever. She'd kept that power coiled in herself, even after she'd been freed from the irons, had struggled to keep it down these weeks, the strain enormous. Some days, it had been easier to barely speak. Some days, swaggering arrogance had been her key to ignoring it. Yet when she had seen that wave, when she had seen Elide and Lorcan choosing death together, when she had seen the army that might save Terrasen, she'd known. She'd felt the fire sleeping under this city, and knew they had come here for a reason. She had come here for this reason. A river still flowed from the dam, harmless and small, wending toward the lake. Nothing more. Aelin lifted a glowing hand before her, as blessed, cooling emptiness filled her at last. Slowly, starting from her fingertips, the glow faded, as if she were forged anew, forged back into her body, back into Aelin. Clarity, sharp and crystal clear, filled its wake, as if she could see again, breathe again. Inch by inch, the golden glow faded into skin and bone, into a woman once more. Already, a white-tailed hawk launched skyward. But as the last of the glow faded, disappearing out through her toes, Aelin fell to her knees. Fell to her knees in the utter silence of the world, and curled onto her side. She had the vague sense of strong, familiar arms scooping her up, of being carried onto a broad, feathery back, still in those arms, of soaring through the skies, the last of the mist rippling away into the afternoon sun, and then sweet darkness.
Chapter 62.
The Krakens did not scatter to the winds. As one, the 13 and the Krakens flew to the southwest, toward the outer reaches of the Fangs, to another secret camp, since the location of the other was well and truly compromised. Farther from Terrasen, but closer to Morath, at least. A small comfort, Dorian thought, when they found a secure place to camp for the night. The Wyverns might have been able to keep going, but the Krakens on their brooms could not fly for so long. They'd flown until darkness had nearly blinded them all, landing only after the Shadows and Krakens had agreed on a secure place to stay. Watches were set, both on the ground and in the sky. If the two surviving matrons were to retaliate for their humiliating defeat, it would be now. The Krakens and Asterin had spent much of their time today laying misleading tracks, but only time would tell if they'd escaped. The night was frigid enough that they took the time to erect tents, the Wyverns huddling together against one of the rocky overhangs. And though no fires would have been wiser, the cold threatened to be so lethal that Glennis had taken the sacred flame from the glass orb where it was held while traveling and ignited her fire. Others had followed suit, and while glamours would be in place to hide the camp, the fires from enemy eyes, Dorian couldn't entirely forget that the Iron Teeth matrons had found them regardless. They hadn't spoken of where they were going next, what they would do, if they would part ways at last, or remain as one united group. Manon had not asked or pushed them for an alliance, to go to war, hadn't demanded to know where they flew. Such was their dire need to get far from their camp this morning. But tomorrow? Dorian thought, as he slid under the blankets of his bedroll, a lick of flame of his own making warming the space. Tomorrow would force them to confront a few things. Bone tired, chilled despite the magic that warmed him. Dorian slumped his head against the roll of supplies he used for a pillow. Sleep had almost dragged him under, when a burst of cold slithered into the tent, then vanished. He knew who it was before she sat beside his bedroll, and when he opened his eyes, he found Manon with her knees drawn up, arms braced atop them. She stared into the dimness of his tent, the space illumined with silvery light from the glowing stars on her brow. "You don't have to wear it all the time," he said. "We're allowed to take them off." Golden eyes slid toward him. "I've never seen you wear a crown. The past few months haven't provided much access to the royal collection." He sat up. "And I hate wearing them anyway. They dig mercilessly into my head." A hint of a smile. "This is not so heavy. Since it seems made of light itself, I'd imagine not. Though that crown would weigh heavily in other ways, he knew. So, you're talking to me," she said, not bothering to segue gracefully.
"I talked to you before."
"Is it because I am now queen?"
"You were queen prior to today."
Her golden eyes narrowed, scanning him for the answer she sought. Dorian let her do it and returned the favor. Her breathing was steady, her posture at ease for once.
"I thought it would be more satisfying to see her run."
"Her grandmother."
"When you killed your father, what did you feel?" "Rage. Hate."
He didn't balk from the truth in his words, the ugliness. She chewed on her lower lip, no sign of those iron teeth. A rare, silent admission of doubt.
"Do you think I should have killed her?" "Some might say yes. But humiliating her like that,"
he said, considering,
"might weaken her and the Iron Teeth forces more than her death. Killing her might have rallied the Iron Teeth against you."
"I killed the Yellowlegs matron."
"You killed her, spared the Blue Blood Witch, and your grandmother fled. That's a demoralizing defeat. Had you killed them all, even killed just your grandmother and the Yellowlegs matron? It could have turned their deaths into noble sacrifices on behalf of the Iron Teeth clans. She nodded, her golden eyes settling on him again with that preternatural clarity and stillness. I am sorry, she said, for how I spoke when I learned of your plans to go to Morath. He was stunned enough that he just blinked. Stunned enough that humor was his only shield, as he said, Seems like that Kraken do-gooder behavior is rubbing off on you, Manon. A half smile at that. Mother help me if I ever become so dull. But Dorian's amusement faded away. I accept your apology. He held her gaze, letting her see the truth in it. It seemed answer enough for her. Answer, and somehow the final clue to what she sought. Her golden eyes guttered. You're leaving, she breathed. Tomorrow. He didn't bother to lie.
Yes.
It was time. She had faced her grandmother, had challenged what she'd created. It was time for him to do the same. He didn't need Damaris's confirming warmth or the spirits of the dead to tell him that. How?
You witches have brooms and wyverns. I've learned to make my own wings.
For a few breaths, she said nothing. Then she lowered her knees, twisting to face him fully. Morath is a death trap.
It is.
We cannot go with you.
I know.
He could have sworn fear entered her eyes. Yet she didn't rage at him, roar at him, didn't so much as snarl. She only asked, You're not afraid to go alone?
Of course I'm afraid.
Anyone in their right mind would be. But my task is more important than fear, I think.
Anger flickered over her face, her shoulders tensing. Then it faded, and was replaced by something he had seen only earlier today. That queen's face. Steady and wise, edged with sorrow and bright with clarity. Her eyes dipped to the bedroll, then lifted to meet his own. And if I asked you to stay? The question also took him by surprise. He carefully thought through his answer.
I'd need a very convincing reason, I suppose.
Her fingers went to the buckles and buttons of her leathers and began to loosen them.
Because I don't want you to go,
was all she said. His heart thundered as she revealed inch after inch of bare, silken skin. Not a seductive removal of her clothing, but rather an offer laid bare. Her fingers began to shake, and Dorian moved at last, helping her to remove her boots, then her sword belt. He left her jacket open, the swells of her breasts just visible between the lapels. They rose and fell in an uneven rhythm that only turned more unsteady as she reached between them and began to remove his own jacket. Dorian let her peel off his jacket, then the shirt beneath. Outside, the wind howled. And when they kneeled before each other, bare from the waist up, that crown of stars still atop her head, Manon said softly, We could make an alliance between Otterlin and the Krakens, and any Iron Teeth who might follow me. It was her answer, he realized, to his request for a convincing reason to remain. She took his hand and interlaced their fingers. It was more intimate than anything they'd shared, more vulnerable than she'd ever allowed herself to be. An alliance, she said, throat bobbing. Between you and me. Her golden eyes lifted to his, the offer gleaming there. To marry. To unite their peoples in the strongest, most unbreakable of terms.
You don't want that,
he said with equal quiet.
You would never want to be shackled to any man like that.
He could see the truth there, in her beautiful face. That she agreed with him. But she shook her head, the starlight dancing on her hair.
The Krakens have not offered to fly to war. I have not yet dared ask them.
But
If I had the strength of Otterlin beside me, perhaps they might be convinced at last. If they had not been convinced by today's triumph, then nothing would change their minds. Even their queen offering up the freedom she craved so badly. That Manon would even consider it, though. Dorian twined a wave of her silver hair around his finger. For a heartbeat, he allowed himself to drink her in. She would be his wife, his queen. She was already his equal, his match, his mirror in so many ways. And with their union, the world would know it. But he could see the bars of the cage that would creep closer, tighter every day, and either break her wholly, or turn her into something neither of them wished her to ever be. You would marry me? All so we could aid Terrasen in this war? Aelin is willing to die to end this conflict. Why should she bear the brunt of sacrifice? And there it was. Her answer. Though he knew she didn't realize it. Sacrifice. Dorian's other hand went to the buttons of her pants and freed them with a few deft maneuvers, revealing the long, thick scar across her abdomen. Would he have shown the restraint that Manon did today, had he faced her grandmother? Absolutely not. He ran his fingers over the scar, over it, and then up her stomach. Up and up, her skin pebbling beneath his touch, until he halted just over her heart. Until he laid his palm flat against it, the curve of her breast rising to meet his hand with each unsteady breath she took. You were right, she said quietly. I am afraid. Manon laid her hand over his. I am afraid that you will go into Morath and return as something I do not know. Something I shall have to kill.
I know.
Those same fears haunted his steps. Her fingers tightened on his, pressing harder, as if she were trying to imprint his hand upon the heart racing beneath. Would you stay here, if we had this alliance between us? He heard every word left unspoken. So Dorian brushed his mouth against hers. Manon let out a small sound. Dorian kissed her again, and her tongue met his, hungry and searching. Then her hands were plunging into his hair, both of them rising onto their knees to meet halfway. She moaned, her hands sliding from his hair down his chest, down to his pants. She stroked him through the material, and Dorian groaned into her mouth. Time spun out, and there was only Manon, a living blade in his arms. Their pants joined their shirts and jackets on the ground, and then he was laying her upon his bedroll. Manon drew her hands from him to remove the glittering crown atop her head. But he halted her with a phantom touch.
Don't,
he said, voice near guttural.
Leave it on.
Her eyes turned to molten gold, going heavy-lidded as she writhed, tipping her head back. His mouth went dry at the beauty that threatened to undo him, the temptation that his every instinct roared to claim. Not the body, but what she had offered. He almost said yes then. Was almost selfish enough, greedy enough for her that he nearly said yes. Yes, he would take her as his queen. So he might never have to say farewell to this. So that this magnificent, fierce witch might remain by his side for all his days. Manon reached for him, fingers digging into his shoulders, and Dorian rose over her, finding her mouth in a plundering kiss. A shift of her hips, and he was buried, the heated silk of her enough to make him forget that they had a camp around them, or kingdoms to protect. He did not bother with phantom touches. He wanted her all for himself, skin to skin. Every thrust into her, Manon answered with a rolling, demanding movement of her own. Stay, the word echoed in each breath. Dorian took one of her legs and hefted it higher, angling him closer. He groaned at the perfection of it, and Manon swallowed the sound with a kiss of her own, a hand clamping on his backside to propel him harder, faster. Dorian gave Manon what she wanted, gave himself what he wanted.
over and over and over, as if this might last forever. Manon's breathing was as ragged as Dorian's when they pulled apart at last. She could barely move her limbs, barely get down enough air as she gazed at the tent ceiling. Dorian, as spent as she, didn't bother to try to speak. What was left to be said anyway? She'd laid out what she wanted, had spoken as much of the truth as she dared voice. In its wake, a sated sort of clarity shone, such as she had not felt in a long, long time. His sapphire eyes lingered on her face, and Manon turned toward him, slowly removed her crown of stars and set it aside. Then she drew up the blankets around them both. He didn't so much as flinch as she scooted closer, into the solid muscle of his body. No. Dorian only draped an arm over her and pulled her tightly against him. Manon was still listening to his breathing when she fell asleep, warm in his arms. She awoke at dawn to a cold bed. Manon took one look at the empty place where the king had been, at the lack of supplies and that ancient sword, and knew. Dorian had gone to Morath and had taken the two word keys with him.
Chapter 63. Adian and Killian kept their panicking troops in line as they marched, all the way to the banks of the Florine. There was no use running northward, not when the bone drums began pounding, and grew louder with every passing minute that Adian ordered their legion into formation. Stalking for the front lines, his armor so heavy it could have been made of stone, the lack of the ancient sword at his side like some phantom limb, Adian said to Ren,
"I need you to do me a favor."
Ren, buckling on his quiver, didn't bother to look up.
"Don't tell me to run." "Never."
Close. They were so close to Thoralis. How fitting it would have been to at last die on the field where Terrasen had fallen a decade ago. To have his blood soak into the earth where so many of the court he'd loved had died. For his bones to join theirs, unmarked on the plain.
"I need you to call for aid."
Ren looked up then. His scarred face was leaner than it had been weeks ago. When was the last time any of them had had a proper meal, or a full night's rest? Where Lysandra was, what form she wore, Adian didn't know. He had not sought her out last night, and she had stayed away from him entirely.
"I'm no one now,"
Adian said, the lines of soldiers parting for them. Bane and Fae, silent assassin and Wendlinian and wastes-hailing soldier alike.
"But you are Lord of Alsbrook. Send out messengers. Send out Nox Owen. Call for aid. Dispatch them to every direction, to anyone they might find. Tell Nox and the others to beg if they have to. But tell them to say that Terrasen calls for aid."
Only Aelin had the authority to do so, or Darrow and his council. But Adian didn't care. Ren halted, and Adian paused with him, well aware of the soldiers within earshot, of the Fae hearing many possessed. Endymion and Selene already stood by the front line of the left flank, their faces grave and weary. A home, that was what they'd lost, what they now fought to gain, if any should survive this. What would his father make of his son, fighting alongside his people at last?
"Will anyone come?"
Ren asked, aware of those listening ears, too. Aware of the grim faces that remained with them, despite the death that marched at their backs. Adian fitted his helmet onto his head, the metal bitingly cold.
"None came 10 years ago. But maybe someone will bother this time."
Ren gripped his arm, tugging him close.
"There might be nothing left to defend, Adian." "Send out the call anyway."
He jerked his chin to the lines they'd passed through. Ilias was polishing his blades among a cluster of his father's assassins, his attention pinned on the enemy ahead, preparing to make a final stand on this snowy plain so far from his warm desert.
You insist I'm still your general? Then here's my final order. Call for aid.
A muscle feathered in Ren's jaw, but he said,
Consider it done.
Then he was gone. They didn't bother with goodbyes. Their luck was bad enough. So Adian continued, alone, to the front lines. Two Bane soldiers stepped aside to make room, and Adian hefted up his shield, seamlessly fitting it between their unified front. The metal wall against which Morath would strike first and hardest. The snows swirled, veiling all beyond 100 or so feet. Yet the bone drums pounded louder. Soon the earth shook beneath marching feet. Their final stand. Here on an unnamed field before the Florine. How had it come to this?
Adian drew his sword, the other soldiers following suit, the cry of ringing metal cutting through the howling wind.
Morath appeared, a line of solid black emerging from the snow. Each foot they gained, more appeared behind. How far back was that witch tower? How soon would its power be unleashed? He prayed, for the sake of his soldiers, that it would be quick and relatively painless, that they would not know much fear before they were blasted into ashes. The Bane didn't clash their swords on their shields this time. There was only the marching of Morath and the drums. Had they gone to Orinth when Darrow demanded, they would have made it. Had time to cross the bridge or take the northern route. This defeat, these deaths, rested upon his shoulders alone. Down the line, motion caught his eye. Just as a fuzzy, massive head poked between Prince Galen and one of his remaining soldiers. A ghost leopard. Green eyes slid toward him, drained and bleak. Adian looked away first. This would be bad enough without knowing she was here. That Lysandra would undoubtedly stay until she too fell. He prayed he went first, so he wouldn't witness it. Morath drew close enough that Ren's order to the archers rang out. Arrows flew, fading into the snows. Morath sent an answering volley that blotted out the watery light. Adian angled his shield, crouching low. Every impact reverberated through his bones. Grunts and screams filled their side of the battlefield. When the volley stopped, when they straightened again, many men did not rise with them. It was not arrows alone that had been fired and now peppered the snow, but heads, human heads, many still in their helmets, bearing Ansel of Briarcliff's roaring wolf insignia. The rest of the army that she'd promised, that they'd been waiting for. They must have intercepted Morath and been obliterated. Shouts rose from the army behind him as the realization rippled through the ranks. One female voice in particular carried over the din, her mournful cry echoing through Adian's helmet. The milky, wide eyes of the decapitated head that had landed near his boots stared skyward. The mouth still open, in a scream of terror. How many had Ansel known? How many friends had been amongst them? It wasn't the time to seek out the young queen, to offer his condolences. Not when neither of them would likely survive the day. Not when it might be the heads of his own soldiers that were launched at Orinth's walls. Ren ordered another volley, their arrows so few compared to what had been unleashed seconds before. A spattering of rain compared to a downpour. Many found their marks, soldiers in dark armor going down. But they were replaced by those behind them, mere cogs in some terrible machine.
We fight as one!
Adian called down the line, forcing himself to ignore the scattered heads.
We die as one.
A horn blared from deep within the enemy ranks. Morath began its all-out run on their front line. Adian's boots dug into the mud as he braced his shield arm, like it could possibly hold back the tide stretching into the horizon. He counted his breaths, knowing they were limited. A ghost leopard's snarl ripped down the line, a challenge to the charging army. 50 feet. Wren's archers still fired fewer and fewer arrows. 40. 30. The sword in his hand was no equal to the ancient blade he'd worn with such pride, but he'd make it work. 20. 10. Adian sucked in a breath. The black, depthless eyes of the Morath soldiers became clear beneath their helmets. Morath's front line angled their swords, their spears. Roaring fire blasted from the left flank. His left flank. Adian didn't dare take his focus off the enemy upon him, but several of the Morath soldiers did. He slaughtered them for it, slaughtered their stunned companions too, as they whirled toward another blast of flame. Aelin. Aelin! Soldiers behind him shouted, in triumph and relief. Close the gap, Adian growled to the warriors on either side of him, and pulled back enough to see the source of their salvation, free and safe at last. It was not Aelin who unleashed fire upon the left flank. It was not Aelin at all who had crept up through the snow-veiled river. Ships filled the Florine, near ghosts in the swirling snows. Some bore the banners of their united fleet. But many, so many he couldn't count, bore a cobalt flag adorned with a green sea dragon. Rolf's fleet. The Mycenaeans. Yet there was no sign of the ancient sea dragons who had once gone into battle with them. Only human soldiers marched across the snow, each bearing a familiar-looking contraption, scarves over their mouths. Fire lances. A horn blasted from the river, and then the fire lances unleashed white-hot flame into Morath's ranks, as if they were plumes from hell. Dragons, all of them, spewing fire upon their enemy. Flame melted armor and flesh, and burned the demons that dreaded heat and light. As if they were farmers burning their reaped fields for the winter, Rolf's Mycenaeans marched onward, fire lances spewing, until they formed a line between Adian and their enemy. Morath turned and ran, outright sprinted, their warning cries rising above the bellowing flames. The Firebringer has armed them, her power burns anew. The fools did not realize that there was no magic, none beyond pure luck and good timing. Then a familiar voice rang out, "Quickly! On board, all of you!" Rolf. For the ships in the river had pulled up, gangways lowered and rowboats already at the shore. Adian wasted no time. "To the river! To the fleet!" Their soldiers didn't hesitate. They sprinted for the awaiting armada, onto any ship they could reach, leaping into the longboats. Chaotic and messy, but with Morath on retreat for only the gods knew how long, he didn't care. Adian kept his position at the front line, ensuring no soldier lagged behind. Down the line, Prince Galen and a spotted furry form did the same. Beside them, red hair waving in the wind, Ansel of Briarcliff held her sword pointed at their enemy. Tears slid down her freckled cheeks. The heads of her men lay scattered in the snow around her. And ahead of them, still unleashing flame, Rolf's Mycenaeans bought them the time to retreat. Each second dripped by, but slowly, those boats filled. Slowly, their army left the shore. Every boat that departed was replaced by another. Many fae shifted, birds of prey filling the gray sky as they soared over the river. And when there were none left but a few boats, among them a beautiful ship with a mast carved after an attacking sea dragon, Rolf roared from the helm, "Fall back, all of you!" The Mycenaeans and their fire lances made a quick retreat, hurrying for the longboats returning to shore. Lysandra and Ansel ran with them, and Adian followed suit. It was the longest sprint of his life. But then he was at the gangplank of Rolf's ship, the river deep enough that they'd been able to pull up close to the shore. Lysandra, Galen, and Ansel were already past him, and Adian had barely cleared the deck when the gangway was lifted. Below, around, the Mycenaeans leaped into their longboats and rowed like hell. Not a single soldier left behind. Only the dead Light flashed. An Adian whirled toward the ship's helm in time to see Lysandra shift from ghost leopard to woman, naked as the day she was born. Rolf, to his credit, only looked mildly surprised as she flung her arms around his neck. And to his credit once more, the pirate lord wrapped his cloak around her before he gripped her back. Adian reached them, panting and so relieved he might vomit upon the shining planks. Rolf let go of Lysandra, offering her his cloak completely. As the shifter wrapped it around herself, he said,
"You looked like you were in need of a rescue."
Adian only embraced the man, then nodded toward Rolf's gloved hands.
"I assume we have that map of yours to thank. Turns out it's good for something other than plundering,"
Rolf smirked.
"Ravian, soul of Surya, intercepted us near the northern border,"
he admitted.
"They thought you might be in trouble and sent us this way."
He ran a hand through his hair.
"They remain with what's left of your fleet, guarding the coast. If Morath attacks from the sea, they won't have enough ships to stand a chance. I told them that, and they still ordered me here."
The pirate lord's tan face tightened.
"So here I am."
Adian hardly noticed the sailors and soldiers making the quick sailing to the other side of the river.
"Thank you,"
he breathed, "and thank the gods for Ravian's soul." Rolf shook his head, gazing toward the mass of Morath soldiers still retreating.
"We surprised them, but it won't hold them off for long."
Lysandra stepped to Rolf's side. Adian tried not to cringe at the sight of her bare feet and legs, her uncovered shoulders, as the bitter wind off the river bit at them.
"We only need to get to Orinth and behind its walls. From there we can regroup."
"I can't carry your entire army to Orinth,"
Rolf said, gesturing to the soldiers massed on the far shore.
"But I can bear you there now, if you would like to arrive in advance to prepare."
The pirate lord studied the shore, as if looking for someone.
"She's not here, is she?"
Lysandra shook her head.
"No."
"Then we'll make do,"
was all Rolf said, the portrait of cool command. His sea-green eyes slid to where Ansel of Briarcliff stood at the ship's rail, staring toward the field of heads left in the snow. None of them spoke, as the young queen slid to her knees, armor thunking on the deck, and bowed her head. Adian murmured,
"Let me send word to our troops to march to Orinth, and then we'll sail for the city."
"I'll do it,"
Lysandra said, not looking at him. She didn't bother to say anything else. Cloak falling to the planks, she shifted into a falcon and aimed for where Killian now climbed out of a longboat. They exchanged only a few words before Killian turned toward Adian and lifted a hand in farewell. Adian raised one in answer, and then Lysandra shifted again. When she landed on the ship, returning to her human form and snatching up the cloak, it was to Ansel that she walked. In silence, the shifter laid a hand on the queen's armored shoulder. Ansel didn't so much as glance up. Adian asked Rolf,
"How many of those fire lances do you have?"
The pirate lord drew his gaze from Ansel to the black mass fading behind them. His mouth tightened.
"Not enough to outlast a siege."
And even the fire lances would do nothing. Absolutely nothing. Once the witch towers reached Orinth's walls. Chapter 64. Hours later, Irene was still shaking. At the disaster they'd narrowly avoided, at the deaths she'd witnessed before that wave had struck, at the power of the queen on the plain, the power of the prince who had prevented the ensuing steam from boiling alive any caught in its path. Irene had thrown herself back into healing during the chaos since, had left the royals and their commanders to oversee the aftermath, and had returned to the great hall. Healers drifted onto the battlefield, searching for those in need of help. All of them,
every single person in the keep or the skies or on the battlefield, kept glancing toward the now empty gap between two mountain peaks. Toward the flooded, decimated city and the demarcation line between life and death. Water and debris had destroyed most of Aniel, the former now trickling toward the Silver Lake. A vision of what would have been left of them, were it not for Aelin Galathinius. Irene knelt over a Rook rider, the woman's chest slashed open from a sword blow, and held out her bloodied, glowing hands. Magic, clean and bright, flowed from her into the woman, mending torn skin and muscle. The blood loss would take time to recover from, but the woman had not lost so much of it that Irene needed to expend her energy on refilling its levels. She needed to rest soon, for a few hours. She'd been asked to inspect the queen when she'd been carried into a private chamber by Prince Rowan, the two of them borne off the plane by Nezrin. Irene hadn't been able to stop her hands from shaking, as she'd hovered them over Aelin's unconscious body. There had been no sign of harm beyond a few already healing cuts and slices from the battle itself. Nothing at all beyond a sleeping, tired woman who held the might of a god within her veins. Irene had then inspected Prince Rowan, who looked in far worse shape, a sizable gash snaking down his thigh. But he'd waved her off, claiming he'd come too near a burnout and just needed to rest as well. So Irene had left them, only to tend to another. To Lorcan, whose injuries... Irene had needed to summon Hafiza to help her with some of it, to lend her power, since Irene's had been so depleted. The unconscious warrior, who had apparently tumbled right off Farasha as he and Elide had passed through the gates, didn't so much as stir while they worked on him. That had been hours ago. Days ago, it felt. Yes, she needed to rest. Irene aimed for the water station in the back of the hall, her mouth dry as paper. Some water, some food, and perhaps a nap. Then she'd be ready to work again. But a horn, clear and bright, blared from outside. Everyone halted, then rushed to the windows. Irene's smile grew as she too found a place to peek out over the battlefield. To where the rest of the Coggins army, Prince Caution at its front, marched toward them. Thank the gods. Everyone in the hall muttered similar words. From the keep, an answering horn sang its welcome. Not just one army had been spared here today, Irene realized, as she turned back to the water station. If that wave had reached Caution, lucky. They had all been so, so very lucky. Yet Irene wondered how long that luck would last. If it would see them through the brutal march northward, and to the walls of Orinth itself. Lorcan let out a low groan as he surfaced from the warm, heavy embrace of darkness. You are one lucky bastard. Too soon. Too damn soon after hovering near death to hear Fenris's drawl. Lorcan cracked open an eye, finding himself lying on a cot in a narrow chamber. A lone candle illuminated the space, dancing in the golden hair of the Fey warrior who sat in a wooden chair at the foot of his bed. Fenris's smirk was a slash of white. You've been out for a day. I drew the short stick and had to look after you. A lie. For whatever reason, Fenris had chosen to be here. Lorcan shifted his body. Slightly. No hint of pain beyond a dull throb down his back and tight pull across his stomach. He managed to lift his head enough to rip away the heavy wool blanket covering his naked body. Where he'd been able to see his insides, only a thick red scar remained. Lorcan thumped his head back on the pillow.
Elide.
Her name was a rasp on his tongue. The last he remembered, they'd ridden through the gates, Aelin Galathinius's unholy power spent. Then oblivion had swept in. Helping with the healing in the Great Hall, Fenris said, stretching out his legs before him. Lorcan closed his eyes, something tight in his chest easing.
Well, since you're not dead, Fenris began. But Lorkin was already asleep. Lorkin awoke later. Hours, days, he didn't know. The candle was still burning on the narrow windowsill, down to its base. Hours, then. Unless he'd slept so long, they'd replaced the candle altogether. He didn't care. Not when the dim light revealed the delicate woman lying face down on the end of his cot. The lower half of her body still on the wooden chair where Fenris had been. Her arms cradled her head, one outstretched toward him. Reaching for his hand, mere inches from hers. Elide. Her dark hair spilled across the blanket, across his shins, veiling much of her face. Wincing at the lingering ache in his body, Lorkin stretched his arm just enough to touch her fingers. They were cold, their tips so much smaller than his. They contracted, pulling away as she sucked in a sharp, awakening breath. Lorkin savored every feature as she grimaced at a crick in her neck. But her eyes settled on him. She went still as she found him staring at her, awake and utterly in awe of the woman who had ridden through hell to find him. Tired. She looked spent, yet her chin remained unbowed. Lorkin had no words. He'd given her everything on the back of that horse anyway. But Elide asked, "How do you feel?" Aching, exhausted, yet finding her sitting at his bedside. "Alive," he said, and meant it. Her face remained unreadable, even as her eyes dipped to his body. The blanket had slid down enough to reveal most of his torso, though it still hid the scarred-over wound in his abdomen. Yet he'd never felt so keenly naked. It was an effort to keep his breathing steady beneath her sharp-eyed gaze. "Irene said you would have died if they hadn't gotten to you when they did."
"I would have died,"
he said, voice like gravel,
"if you hadn't braved hell to find me."
Her gaze lifted to his.
"I made you a promise."
"So you said."
Was that a hint of color stealing across her pale cheeks? But she didn't balk.
"You said some interesting things, too."
Lorkin tried to sit up, but his body gave a burst of pain in protest. Elide explained,
"Irene warned that though the wounds are healed, some soreness will linger."
Lorkin gritted his teeth around the sharp stab in his back, his stomach. He managed to get onto his elbows and deemed that progress enough.
"It's been a while since I was so gravely injured. I'd forgotten what an inconvenience it is."
A faint smile tugged on her mouth. His heart halted. The first smile she had given him in months and months, since that day on the ship, when he'd touched her hand as they swayed in their hammocks. Her smile faded, but the color on her cheeks lingered.
"Did you mean it? What you said?"
He held her stare, let some inner wall within him come crumbling down. Only for her, for this sharp-eyed, cunning little liar who had slipped through every defense and ironclad rule he'd ever made for himself. He let her see that in his face. Let her see all of it, as no one had ever done before.
"Yes."
Her mouth tightened, but not in displeasure. So Lorkin said softly,
"I meant every word."
His heart thundered, so wildly it was a wonder she couldn't hear it.
"And I will, until the day I fade into the afterworld."
Lorkin didn't breathe as Elide gently reached out her hand and interlaced their fingers.
"I love you,"
she whispered. He was glad he was lying down. The words would have knocked him to his knees. Even now, he was half inclined to bow before her, the true owner of his ancient, wicked heart.
"I have loved you," she went on, "from the moment you came to fight for me against Vernon and the Ilken."
The light in her eyes stole his breath.
"And when I heard you were somewhere on that battlefield, The only thing I wanted was to be able to tell you that. It was the only thing that mattered. Once, he might have scoffed, declared that far bigger things mattered, in this war especially. And yet the hand grasping his, he'd never known anything more precious. Lorkin ran his thumb over the back of her hand.
I am sorry, Elite, for all of it.
I know, she said softly, and no regret or hurt dimmed her face. Only clear, unwavering calm shone there. The face of the mighty lady she was growing into, and had already become, and who would rule Peranth with wisdom in one hand and compassion in the other. They stared at each other for minutes, for a blessed eternity. Then Elide untangled their hands and rose. I should return to help Irene.
Lorkin caught her hand again.
Stay.
She arched a dark brow.
I'm only going to the Great Hall.
Lorkin caressed his thumb over the back of her hand once more.
Stay.
He breathed. For a heartbeat, he thought she'd say no, and was prepared to be fine with it, to accept these last few minutes as more of a gift than he'd deserved. But then Elide sat on the edge of his cot, right beside his shoulder, and ran a hand through his hair. Lorkin closed his eyes, leaning into the touch, unable to stop the deep purr that rolled through his chest. She made a low noise of wonder, perhaps something more, and her fingers stroked again.
Say it,
she whispered, fingers stilling in his hair. Lorkin opened his eyes, finding her gaze.
I love you.
She swallowed hard, and Lorkin gritted his teeth as he sat up fully. This close, he had forgotten how much he towered over her. Atop that horse, she had been a force of nature, a defiant storm. His blanket slipped dangerously low, but he let it lie where it pooled in his lap. He didn't miss the dip of her stare, or the long upward drag of her eyes along his torso. He could almost feel it, lingering on every muscle and scar. A soft groan came out of him as she continued to look her fill, asking for things that he sure as hell was in no shape to give her, and that she might not yet be ready to give him, declarations aside. He was immediately challenged to prove his resolve, as Elide ran slightly shaking fingers across the new scar on his abdomen.
Irene said, you might always have this, she said,
her hand mercifully falling away.
Then it will be the scar I treasure most.
Fenris would laugh until he cried to hear him speak this way. But Lorkin didn't care. To hell with the rest of them. Another one of those small smiles curved her lips, and Lorkin's hands tightened in the sheets with the effort it took not to taste that smile, to worship it with his own mouth. But this new, fragile thing humming between them. He would not risk it for all the world. Elide, thank the gods, had no such worries. None at all, it seemed, as she lifted a hand to his cheek and ran her thumb along it. Every breath was an effort of control. Lorkin held absolutely still as she brought her mouth to his, brushed her lips across his own. She pulled back.
Rest, Lorkin. I'll be here again when you wake.
Anything she asked, he'd give her. Anything at all. Too shaken by that soft, beautiful kiss to bother with words, he lay back down. She smiled at his utter obedience and, as if she couldn't help herself, leaned in once more. This kiss lingered. Her mouth traced his, and at the slightest pressure of her lips, the gentle request, he answered with his own. The taste of her threatened to undo him entirely, and the tentative brush of her tongue against his own drew another rolling purr from deep in his chest. But Lorkin let Elide explore him, slowly and sweetly, giving her whatever she asked. And when her mouth became more insistent, when her breathing turned ragged, he slipped a hand around her neck to cup her nape, She opened for him, and at her low moan, Lorcan thought he'd fly out of his skin. His hand slipped from her nape to run down her back, savoring the warm, unbreakable body beneath the layers of clothes. Elide arched into the touch, another of those small noises coming from her, as if she'd been just as starved for him. But Lorcan made himself pull away, made himself withdraw his hand from her lower back. Panting slightly, sharing breath, he said onto her mouth,
"Later, go help the others."
Dark eyes glazed with desire met his, and Lorcan adjusted the fall of the blanket over his lap.
"Go help the others,"
he repeated.
"I'll be here when you're ready to sleep."
The unspoken request lingered, and Elide pulled back, studying him once more.
"Sleep only,"
Lorcan said, not bothering to hide the heat rising in his stare.
"For now."
Until she was ready. Until she told him, showed him, she wished to share everything with him. That final claiming. But until then, he wanted her here, sleeping at his side, where he might watch over her,
as she had watched over him.
Elide's face was flushed as she rose, her hands shaking.
Not from fear,
but from the same effort that it now took Lorcan not to reach for her. He'd very much enjoyed driving her out of her mind, slowly teaching her all he knew about pleasure, about wanting. He had little doubt he'd be learning a good number of things from her, too.
Elide seemed to read that on his face, and her cheeks reddened further.
"Later, then,"
she breathed, limping to the door. Lorcan sent a flicker of his power to wrap around her ankle. The limp vanished. A hand on the knob, she gave him a small, grateful nod.
"I missed that."
He heard the unspoken words as she disappeared.